Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome to Counterpunch Radio. I'm your program producer, Nathaniel St. Clair, and today's episode is brought to you in partnership with Haymarket Books. You know Haymarket. It is one of, if not the best publisher of left-wing books in the world. Just a massive collection of lefty literature that will enlighten, challenge, and fascinate listeners of this show. One that I highly recommend is I Know What the Red Clay Looks Like by Rebecca Carroll. 30 years after its original publication, this newly imagined edition brings the work and musings of 15 Black literary luminaries into conversation with a new generation of writers and readers. The first edition, published in 1994, remains an essential text for readers of Black feminist literature. Now, Rebecca Carroll presents the original conversations alongside personalized introductions by some of the brightest voices in today's literary world. You can find I Know What the Red Clay Looks Like at haymarketbooks.org, where all paperbacks are 20% off every day. All right, on today's episode, Eric Wallenberg and Joshua Frank welcome Kim Kelly and Hamilton Nolan to the show to focus on labor. These are two of the leading experts on the subject. Both have been writing about labor for a wide variety of publications for many, many years, and both have written excellent books detailing its past and present. Kim Kelly authored Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, and Hamilton Nolan wrote The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. You need to get your hands and eyes on both of those if you haven't already. But before we get to the interview, I want to give you a peek at the paid portion of our website and remind you that becoming a Counterpunch Plus member is the best way to support our publication. What you will find there isn't bonus content, it isn't fluff, it's first-rate, hard-hitting investigative journalism. For example, this illuminating piece by Arvin Dillower titled, Europe Continues to Import Israeli Gas Amid Genocide in Gaza. Here's a snippet. The Israeli genocide in Gaza is possible only with the complicity of other nations and multinational energy corporations, which together provide the fuel that the Israeli military requires for its operations. Israel's largest suppliers of crude oil and liquid fuel include the United States, Brazil, and Azerbaijan. International oil and gas companies supply 35% of Israel's crude oil. Among the companies supplying fuel to Israel are names familiar to consumers in the United States: Chevron, British Petroleum, ExxonMobil, and Shell. But nestled amid the details regarding Israel's energy dependency are facts that appear to be contradictory, namely, that Israel also exports natural gas. Gas from the Leviathan field off the coast of Israel in the Mediterranean Sea is primarily reserved for foreign markets. While governments around the world continue to rebuff their people's demands to institute a weapons embargo on Israel, activists are now taking aim at the companies fueling the Israeli war machine. Not only does that include the companies directly supplying fuel to Israel, but also those exporting fuel from Israel for consumption elsewhere, especially in Europe, and thereby supporting the genocide by other means. End quote. Now, if you don't have the means to become a member at the moment, another way to really help us grow this podcast is simply to subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review on whatever platform you use to listen. All of that is surprisingly important, so we greatly appreciate the support. All right, let's get to what you came here for. Eric and Joshua in conversation with Kim Kelly and Hamilton Nolan.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome to Counterpunch Radio. I'm one of your co-hosts, Eric Wallenberg, here with Josh Frank, your other co-host. We're really excited to have a couple of guests with us today, thinking about labor in these trying times. We're excited to welcome Kim Kelly, who's a freelance journalist and author based in Philadelphia. She's a labor writer for In These Times, a labor columnist at Teen Vogue and Fast Company, and regularly contributes to many other publications, including The New Republic, The Washington Post, and The Baffler. Her first book is Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. We're also joined by Hamilton Nolan, who is a labor writer for In These Times. He spent the past decade writing about labor and politics for Gawker, Splinter, The Guardian, and elsewhere. His first book is The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. Welcome, Kim and Hamilton.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So excited for you to be with us today to talk about so many things. Why don't we start with getting your take on this election and the postmortem of what happened and how we got here? I know it's a big question and there's a lot to address, but Kim, why don't we start with you on that?
Democrats shit the bed. I think that's the most concise sort of analysis. Oh, God, that was only, when did that happen? November? We've all lived 17 lifetimes since November. I don't know, man. I think they had something for a brief moment when they did the switch. Everyone was coconut pilled for a week and a half. People were genuinely excited that it seemed like briefly that one of the two ruling parties was listening a little bit to normal people. And they brought on Tim Walz, who was kind of fun and people seemed to actually like. And there was some actual energy. And then somebody who makes more money than any of us will ever see looked at that and was like, oh, no. This is not what we want. We're going to bring out Liz Cheney and ask the Uber CEO what we should do for workers. And just, it was wild, the amount of unforced error that just seemed to flow like an avalanche in the wake of the two decent decisions they've made in the past 20 years. But it turns out that regular people do not care about what charts look like. They care about reality and how they experience it. And nobody wants a leader that has nothing to say, even if the leader that is offered by the other side, if you will, has a bunch of terrible things to say. If some of that bullshit he's spouting makes it sound like at least that he's listening a little bit to your concerns, or at least not waving them away. I am clearly not a right-wing type of guy, but my family and other people I grew up with are. And so it did not surprise me that things went the way they did. You can hire the smartest economists in the world to be like, no, actually the economy is good. But eggs cost like $6, and that's enough to radicalize anybody, especially someone who doesn't even really like either political choice that they're being offered. I don't know, man. I feel like this thing has been analyzed a lot by people who have spent much more time thinking about it than I have. I'm just like, man, I'm just.
But you live in Philly, right?
In Pennsylvania, the amount of trees that were killed just to pile up mailers in my foyer specifically. No one will leave us alone. The amount of door knocking. Everyone has my number. I hated it. Everybody hated it. Leave us alone. I don't care. And I know that ground game is important theoretically, right? And I do have a lot of empathy and respect for the volunteers that were like, I want to help save democracy. I want to defeat Trump. I'm going to text and phone bank and do all this and knock on doors. They're not the problem. somebody probably could have been a little bit more practical about where those folks were being sent. Oh my God. Living in Pennsylvania during that time was hell. And like, if I'm annoyed about it and I'm like, I'm an extremely reluctant voter to start with, imagine how old it must have gotten for people that, I don't know, pay more attention to that particular dog and pony show.
So you didn't feel the joy, is what you're saying.
Oh my God. The joy, the joy. Man, John Fetterman is my Setterman. Senator. Senator.
Hamilton, Hamilton, how about you? What's your read on this mess?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like the Republicans stand for evil and the Democrats stand for nothing. So if you stand for nothing, people aren't going to be excited about you. And that's kind of the story of the Democratic Party, and maybe a little bit shorter of what Kim was saying right now. I mean, I went to the Democratic convention, and it was bullshit, as all conventions are. But, you know, the one real thing that was happening at that convention was the Palestinians, protesters, and the uncommitted people asking for the smallest crumb from the Democratic Party to allow somebody to go stand on stage for a moment, just to appear on stage. And the Democratic Party told them to fuck off. And I don't think that that's the issue that lost the Democrats the election, but it was such a like emblematic moment to show that the party just does not care. The party does not have principles. And the stuff that Kim said about how they really muzzled Tim Walz and turned to Tony West, and you know, all that stuff is kind of, to me, it's the Democrats' problem is like they don't stand for anything. And Trump stands for something. He stands for fascism. He stands for himself. He stands for hating people. He stands for hating immigrants. He stands for bad things, but he stands for something. He's given people something. And the other thing that my big thought about the election was that there was a lot of talk about the working class is shifting to the right. The working class is shifting to the Republican Party. We're having a realignment of the parties and all that stuff. And I think the thing that got lost in that discussion a lot in the media was that union members and the working class are two different things. And it's important to think about how and why they're different. And union members actually did stick with the Democratic Party. Union members did the things that the Democratic Party wanted to do. And the problem is that only 10% of people in this country are union members today. So again, me and Kim talk a lot about how important the labor movement is and how important it is to revive union membership in this country. But that's the path out of this whole quandary that people are struggling with now about, oh, the working class, and why don't they like Democrats? Because Democrats have better policies. I mean, you need an institution, you need organized labor, you need unions to build that bridge. And so there needs to be a lot more discussion about how do we get more people into unions? How do we create more union members rather than just like this vague vibes discussion about what the working class wants, I think.
Okay, well, let's talk about the landscape for labor now with this incoming Trump administration and his cabinet picks. We might, you know, obviously not confirmed, but with what opposition, right? Will they be opposed? Hamilton, allow me to share this section from your article, if you will. You wrote this article, "Now We Will Get What We Asked For," published just after the election for In These Times. And I feel I can't help but encourage our listeners to read this article, to read all of your articles, Hamilton and Kim. But just to give you a taste of some of this article, Hamilton writes, "The Nixon White House will look like a Zen temple compared to what is coming. Trump's second term will be a wave of pure malevolence. There will be revenge against his enemies, and there will be assaults on innocent and vulnerable Americans of the sort that our government usually reserves only for people overseas. Fringe lunatics will dictate health policy. Mm-hmm. Crypto grifters will dictate economic policy. Christian evangelicals will dictate Middle East policy. Flinty corporate lawyers will dictate labor policy. And the mighty American federal government will be run with all the propriety of a late night infomercial selling miracle cures to insomniacs. The cure will be branded Trump in large golden letters. It won't work. There will be no refunds." I feel like you give us a real sense of what's coming. So I want to both note that, and also, Kim, you write about some of this in your recent column for Teen Vogue, Trump and the labor movement, how the new administration might target workers. So I'm just wondering if you can both take us through some of this, including the possibility of an end to the Labor Relations Board. Kim, I think you talked some about that, and both the challenges, but also the potential possibilities to turn some of these attacks into victories for our side. Is that even just, is that rosy thinking? Is that ridiculous? What are we looking at? What should we be doing here? Hamilton, maybe we could start with you.
It's definitely not a good prognosis for organized labor. Whatever you think of Biden, he was very enthusiastic about organized labor, had a great NLRB president who did, Jennifer Abruzzo, who really worked her ass off to try to improve labor law in this country, even though they can't get good labor law reform through Congress, but the regulatory agency, NLRB, that does most of it, they really, really try their best under Biden to make it more friendly to unions and workers. So all that's going away. The NLRB, as it is under just about every Republican administration, turns into an agency that fights against workers and unions rather than one that tries to protect them. And as you mentioned, and Kim can talk about this too, but there's a big legal effort to try to really wipe out the entire legal basis for the NLRB's existence and the whole National Labor Relations Act, which is the thing that kind of stabilized labor relations in this country after the Great Depression and all that. It was sort of the grand bargain between the government and labor and business to be like, here's how this is all going to work. We're not going to have chaos. We're going to have an agency and we're going to regulate it, and this is how it's going to work. And the right wing is trying to totally wipe that off the map now and really go back to chaos, because they obviously feel empowered and they feel that labor is so weak that they will win by doing that. Hopefully that won't happen. It will not be good. It is not a sunny prognosis. Like, it is not cool that that's going to happen. But if it does happen, which is a distinct possibility, everybody in the labor movement and everybody who's a worker needs to start thinking about how are we going to assert our power without this whole framework and protection of the federal government and the courts. We're not going to be able to go running to the regulators anymore and say these businesses are cheating. But you have to think about how we can do that ourselves. And that's a real new way for the labor movement to think. Now, it wasn't new 100 years ago. That's how they were thinking. But there was a lot of struggles to get us to this point. And if we get rolled back, it's going to be a big process of getting down to the grassroots of how you build power.
So something that I've been thinking about a lot is it kind of in, so we've heard a lot about Project 2025, right? We know that sucks. And one thing about it that has been troubling me as someone who pays a lot of attention to labor and workers' rights and workers' safety is that part of the, I guess, mandate for that is that they want to purge federal agencies of non-loyal, non-Trumpist, non-partisan workers. And that's kind of an unwieldy big picture thing to think about, that will they pull it off? Who's to say? But something that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of that is, like, when we talk about regulatory agencies and standards, all this kind of boring or at least less sexy stuff, there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are doing really important work at agencies like OSHA, like the Occupational Safe and Health Administration, like the people that if someone gets hurt at your job, if things aren't safe at your workplace, like they're supposed to be the people you call. They're supposed to at the very least do something, whether it's enough, that is a much different conversation. It's usually not, but there's supposed to be someone you can call if things are fucked up. And if, for example, OSHA gets completely wiped out, all of the nice, normal people there that are working on the federal heat standard, or people in the Mine Safety Administration, Mine Safety and Health Administration, that are working on combating black lung. If all those people get wiped out and a bunch of just evil, like DC frat boys get installed, and then they don't do anything or they actively do things that are bad, like that's going to hurt people in a very kind of tangible material way. Like if you work in construction, if you work in a kitchen, if you work in a lot of different industries, you're very familiar with OSHA. If you're a coal miner or like a miner of any type, you're familiar with MSHA, or even the Department of Labor. There are so many kind of behind the scenes things happening that do protect workers in this country and do make things better for us, that's potentially going to go away. If we have these very anti-labor cabinet picks or just officials, people being installed in these positions, you know, Trump's potential Secretary of Labor seems like potentially not the most evil person he could pick. I know the Teamster Sean O'Brien, his new BFF, is getting a lot of credit for that, for him picking this Oregon congresswoman who's like kind of tepidly pro-labor, as opposed to, you know, last time he tried to install the I think it was Andy Puzder, like this evil fast food billionaire, to be in charge of the Department of Labor. So it's, even if we have someone like a little bit not evil at the top of this agency, that's one person. There are a lot of moving parts in these agencies. And again, this is not the sexiest thing. This is not the most potentially relevant to building worker power and the labor movement in it, like as it is. But like Hamilton said, there's only like 10% of workers in this country in a union. There's a lot of other people that aren't necessarily part of the labor movement in a way that they would recognize right now. And they need to be protected too. And I'm not entirely sure what we do about this. I think it's almost a wait and see kind of approach. Like, is the DOL going to be the first site of the purge, or is it going to be the DOJ, all these other places? Like, labor isn't quite as sexy for evil conservative Republicans. It's kind of a little bit more of an afterthought. So I'm hoping we get a little bit of a grace period. But all that to say, we're going to have to see, and we're going to have to figure out new ways to protect ourselves and protect our people if we lose even the slightest amount of federal and state buffer.
That's a good segue to this next question, I think. Hamilton, you wrote in an article this past election season titled "Forget Elections, Build Your Union." In that piece, you wrote that, quote, "Unions can replace the role that political parties now occupy in our nation. Politicians can be satellites of unions rather than their masters. Electoral politics, that thankless vampire of America's civic engagement, can assume a new and healthier position at the foot of organized labor. The first step to this transformation is simply shifting your own perspective." How do you make labor power political power? It's certainly not the way most unions have done this in the past, i.e., you know, giving union money to politicians and hoping it's bought influence. So I'm wondering if you could talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's one of the points I really try to get across in my book. I think it's the way that the average American thinks about politics is very much like Democrats versus Republicans, red versus blue, CNN versus Fox News, this sort of binary game focused on elections and electoral politics and elected politicians. That is most people's conception of what politics is. But in fact, what politics is just about how you build power and how you exercise power in society. And the average people cannot meaningfully participate in electoral politics in America. Why? Because we're an oligarchy. We have huge economic inequality and money runs our electoral political system. So you, and most people understand this inherently, like you as one person are not going to have that big of an impact on the presidential election. But what all of us do have access to is the labor movement. All of us are workers. And the labor movement and unions and organized labor is really at its core nothing but a way for average people to come together and build their own power as workers. And when you build that power, when you form unions, it's not just a way to exercise power in the workplace where you get more money and you get better working conditions and stuff like that. But unions are political actors in America. And obviously unions participate in our political system, but as you touched on, the main way that most unions have fallen into of participating in politics is just giving money to the Democratic Party, right? And that is not a winner. I mean, they've been doing this for decades and decades, and it has not really improved the status of organized labor. So it would be great to me if instead of looking at the electoral political system and getting pissed off and frustrated with it and saying it sucks and, you know, it's run by money and all those things which are true, you as an average person and a worker say, how can I build power that can be exercised in a political way? And the most direct way and the most meaningful way for most people is to get involved in labor organizing, organize a union, you become part of a national union. A national union has a lot of members, it has a lot of money, and it has a lot of political power. And you can get democratically involved in a union and use that union as the basis to exercise political power. And I guarantee that you will get a lot farther doing that than you will get putting up lawn signs in your yard for one party or the other, or writing angry things on the internet, which is how most people participate in politics. So, you know, you could talk about this for hours, but as a baseline, I just would encourage people to think about what is the source of power that they can't take away from you, even if you don't have money. Your power as a worker and your ability to act in concert with other workers is an inherent power that we all have. And you can only tap into that through unionizing. And so think about how you can unionize your workplace. Think about how you can join a bigger union. Think about how you can get involved in that union to exercise political power. And I think you will be surprised how far you can get with that as compared to yelling at CNN on TV.
So I imagine, Kim, you have things to add to this, but I want to bring up this idea of unions as political actors and think about it in this broader context that Hamilton's laid out. You wrote about actions at ports by labor and Palestinian solidarity activists. It was over a year ago, I think, the last article I read anyway from you on this. And I feel like it's been incredibly disappointing that we haven't seen more action on this front this year. But with the ongoing genocide in Gaza, do you both see this idea of labor taking a stand on this front as increasing? As do you see potentials out there right now? And where might we look for agitation and stepped up action on this front? And I think just in the vein of what Hamilton just said, what other issues out here do we see are motivating people, right? We know it's not just, as Hamilton said, your pay, your benefits. People have bigger horizons and other things in their lives that they care about, and thinking about how we use union action, how we use our collective bargaining power, how we use that on a whole set of issues, on social justice issues as well. So just wondering, Kim, if you might start by saying something about that. And Hamilton, I don't know if you want to say some more on that front as well.
Yeah, this is something I like to try and hammer home whenever I get the opportunity to talk to kind of a big audience of union people, or especially union leaders that maybe aren't seeing things quite the same way as we might. But people's identity as a worker, that is one facet, right? Like, I go to work, I do my job, I'm a worker, but I'm also whatever else that makes up my existence as a human. Like, trans rights are a labor issue. Reproductive rights and bodily autonomy and abortion is a labor issue. Black lives and police brutality and police murder and violence is absolutely a labor issue. The genocide in Palestine is a labor issue. Like, really, labor is part of every struggle and always has been. Like, even back in during the civil rights movement, we had these massive actions for justice. Like, the same people that were going to the March on Washington, like, they had to go to work on Monday. Like, for every struggle for liberation, the women's rights movement, the queer liberation, you don't get to clock out. You don't get to go on vacation just because you're struggling to make the world a better place. Most of us have to contain all of this in one little package we're trying to keep alive. And I think one thing that smart labor leaders and organizers, especially worker organizers, are doing in some sectors are embracing that. Obviously, calling for a ceasefire hasn't gotten us very far. But when that was happening, when we had these major unions, I think it was like the UAW and the flight attendants and postal workers, there's a grip of major national unions that had formed this labor for ceasefire kind of coalition. And obviously, yeah, it didn't go far enough, but it was something. And it was kind of not new, but it was unexpected. And people were energized around that. I think it was important that they took that stand. Obviously, we could talk a lot about how much further they could have gone, about what boycotts look like and what the port workers could have been doing. It's never enough, but it was interesting that something, that there was that kind of inkling that, okay, we should be taking these political stands because this matters to not only our members, but to the international working class. If we're going to say we care about workers, we have to show that. And I really hope we see more of that. I mean, the Republicans are turning trans people's existence itself into some kind of insane war. And our trans siblings are under so much more scrutiny and threat, and so much more threat of violence. And if you are a union leader, you probably almost certainly have trans members. What are you doing to protect them? What are you doing to very loudly and purposefully and publicly support those vulnerable workers? If you put out a press release in 2020 about how Black Lives Matter, what are you doing to back that up 4 years on when all the DEI coordinators have been fired and Black folks are still being murdered in the streets? Like, I would love to see labor in this moment when it is acknowledged that we're dealing with as close to full-blown fascism as a lot of us have seen in our lifetimes, like what that means and what it means to actually fight against that. It's not just signing petitions or donating to the right politicians that like looked at you once at a meeting so they're cool. Like, what are unions and union leaders and organizers going to do to actually support these workers in a material, tangible, meaningful way? Because it's going to get gnarly. Like we've been saying, like Hamilton laid out, it's not going to be a chill few years. And labor's job is to stand up against that and to actually show that, yeah, when we say an injury to one is an injury to all, it's not just like a cool slogan we can throw out on Twitter or whatever. Like, we got to put our money where our mouth is. And I'm really hoping that the movement rises to this occasion, because we really can't afford for them not to. If we want people to get involved politically, if we want people to care about the labor movement and try to help us survive, we got to show that we're worth a damn.
So just thinking about what a dynamic relationship this is, that it's that they help build each other, right? I mean, the social movements that are happening and the labor movement, like when you actually have solidarity between movements, both we're all the same people, as you said, but also when you build movements, people come out for each other. People think about the importance of each other's like movements, siloing, for building, for building strength to strength.
Yeah, sticking to your individual little silo just makes everyone weaker. Like, the point is to build mass power and to show that all of our issues matter, because all of our lives and all of our struggles it's all the same struggle. And letting women's issues or Black folks' issues or immigrant issues or abortion issues all be like kind of put in separate buckets makes it so much easier for them to get pushed aside or just kind of forgotten or over, I don't know the word, get fucked. Mass power. Mass organizing, like masses of people, is everybody. Got to find a place for everybody and show up for everybody.
Do you feel that Trump, in a way, and MAGA in general, has done a good job of co-opting a lot of these conversations? I mean, I'm thinking about using the war on immigration as a way to say, hey, look, immigrants are coming in and stealing your jobs. Talking about tariffs and how tariffs are going to bring back American labor. Of course, it's all bullshit, right? And it's based on a lot of false ideas and racism. But I'm wondering how you all are thinking about this and how can we push back against some of this narrative, which unfortunately, in the mainstream, at least, seems to have been pretty effective.
I think if you look at labor history in America, all of organized labor history, there's been internal debates within the labor movement. So you go inside of any union and you have thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people who have their own different opinions, and there's political debate inside unions and people arguing over how to push the unions. And there's always been inside of organized labor itself, you know, a struggle between sort of the lefties and who want what Kim is talking about, workers of the world unite. And then sort of the conservative wing, which is sort of like, we're here to take care of our own people and fuck everybody else. And that's, you can go back 100 years and there's always that push and pull inside of unions. I think that the promise of unions and what makes unions politically exciting to people like me is that if you are inside of a union, even if you're a Republican, even if you're a Trump voter, even if you're a MAGA person, and you're, for example, a Teamster, plenty of Republicans are Teamster members. The difference between them and somebody who's not in a union is that you can go to that Republican Teamster and say, look, you're in this union and you understand that the source of this union's power is solidarity. So even if you're the biggest Trump voter on earth, you have a personal experience of solidarity in your own life and the power of solidarity and the power of standing with each other against the forces of capital, against the boss. So even Republicans who are in unions have this kind of experience that other people don't have. And you can take that as a seed and say, look, man, when Trump goes and starts deporting people, how many Teamster members is he going to deport? I guarantee you the answer is not zero. Members of the Teamsters are going to be rounded up by ICE and fucking deported from this country. I guarantee it. Now, if you are a Teamster, even if you're a Republican, even if you voted for Trump, you have to stop and say, man, does this conflict with the values that I have in this union, that the values that I've learned through this union, like solidarity with my fellow union members? And so just being in a union gives you a basis of talking to people on a shared set of values that can go beyond red versus blue and all that stuff. I always think about the Warrior Met coal strike, which Kim wrote a ton of great stories about down in Alabama. And I remember when I went to one of their rallies, it was like rural Alabama, as rural as you can get. Surely a ton of those members of that union were Trump voters, no doubt about it. But yet when they had a rally, it was black and white and everybody coming together. And what were they talking about? They were talking about this evil private equity firm that was stepping on their neck, rich people stepping on the neck of working people. They sounded like communists, basically, right? But it's not because they read Karl Marx, you know, it's because they had a real life lived experience. And that's the kind of thing that unions can create, that can sort of break out of these walls that we have around party politics. So I do think that just the step of getting people into unions, getting people involved in the labor movement, gives them a set of values that you can kind of use as a crowbar to get people off some of the stuff that Trump and MAGA people are talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you brought up Warrior Met strike. I still think even though I am deeply biased and very invested in it, I still think that's one of the most interesting and impactful strikes in modern history. And like you said, there's so many examples of like, they're not even really being these lines. Like, I went down there, I spent so much time down there, I got so close to so many people. And on paper, I am the last person anybody in that context would want to talk to at all. And yet we got really close because we care. It was very clear. Okay, very different perspective, very different background, very different worldview. But that common ground of, okay, these rich people are screwing you over. That's not cool. We need to make sure you and your families are taken care of. Honest pay for honest day's work. You should have some time off to take care of your kids. Like, that was a baseline that almost anybody in this entire country can agree on. And those are conveniently also major tenets of organized labor. It's, and I don't want to sound like some kind of like analyst creep, but I feel like branding and the way that people talk about these ideas and talk about these institutions and talk about things has such a big impact. Like you said, there's so many folks in that strike or in other places that were very Trump forward, we'll say, that if you talk to them and say, kids should be safe at school, kids should have school lunches, rich people should pay more damn taxes. Like, most people agree with that. It's just the way that you had those conversations that determines the way, the outcome of that discussion. And being part of a union, being part of organized labor, gives you that immediate common ground, that immediate feeling of, okay, well, we might disagree on a lot of stuff, but we have this common experience. Let's see what we can get out of that. And that's how, like you said, Teamsters being deported or farmers in so much, and agricultural workers in so many parts of the country, like, that's, if this deportation thing shakes out, there are a lot of families that are going to be shattered, a lot of teachers losing students, a lot of retail workers losing their coworkers and their friends, a lot of people just losing the folks they care about in a way that maybe they hadn't thought would happen. Because, oh, well, my friend is one of the, they'll be fine. It's the bad people, the bad people. It's always been the bad people, the others, even within labor, back to when the AFL, the precursor to the AFL-CIO, was vehemently supporting the Chinese Exclusion Act and refusing to organize Latino workers in the South and Southwest because it was competition for their members. Like, there's always been this impulse, even within the annals of organized labor, to kind of have this other, whether it was, it used to be women, and then it was Black folks, and then it was immigrant folks from different places. Still is, obviously, but it's the divide and conquer tactic has been used very effectively by the bosses to split us and make us weaker. And that's one of the reasons we're in the position we are here. So I would just beg folks that do have the bandwidth to have these conversations to emphasize the us against them of it all. It's not the immigrant worker that is there with you on the job site. He's not the reason you're not making enough or your health insurance sucks or you don't have any time off to see your kids. He has the same problem plus some others. It's the people in charge, the people signing your paychecks, the people who are withholding whatever from your taxes. They're the problem. It's not the other person trying to just get a goddamn day's work in and go hang out with his parent, like his family. I think just emphasizing the common humanity is something that the labor movement has a very great opportunity to do if we're smart about it and don't get wrapped up in this historical sort of impetus or inclination to talk about just our members. Like, we can't be protectionist and exclusionist about this. It's the entire class is under threat, and it would be absolutely ridiculous to ignore that and give in to the Josh Hawleys and the other hucksters of the world that say they care about American jobs, but really only mean certain American jobs.
As Trump surrounds himself with billionaires, right? And I'm thinking about like the labor movement, and there have been some pretty significant victories in the last decade. And just because there's an administration that's changing doesn't mean that that movement isn't gaining speed and picking up. And I'm thinking about stuff going on, even at big chains like Starbucks and Amazon organizing and things. So I'm wondering if one of you could talk a little bit about even just some of the victories that we've seen recently and maybe how that can snowball into to more effective change.
I mean, when I was going around the country reporting my book, I talked to people all over the place who would say, either I saw the Starbucks union, I saw a story about the Starbucks union, or I saw a story about the Amazon union, and that inspired me to say why can't I organize a union in my workplace? And like those two campaigns in particular, you know, partly just because of the amount of press they got, the amount of attention they got, I do think really opened a lot of people's eyes, opened a lot of young people's eyes who didn't really have a connection to the labor movement. Because one of the problems with the labor movement in general is that it's declined so much that most people don't grow up in a union household. Most people don't have parents or relatives who are union members today. So a lot of people just don't have any connection to unions. They don't think about unions. They don't know that much about unions. It's really off their radar. So seeing 500 Starbucks stores unionize over a couple of years all across the country, including in red states, and seeing those Amazon workers go out and fight their ass off and win the election in Staten Island and try to start scaling that up around the country, which is going to be a huge fight. That's both of those companies are going to have huge fights that go on for years and years. Starbucks is probably going to get a contract, it sounds like, and Amazon is going to fight forever against getting a contract. So it's still a little early to say how those are going to turn out. But, you know, just the existence of those two campaigns over the past 2-3 years, I think really has inspired a new generation of people who did not know that much about the labor movement. And really, every time there's a big strike, when you saw the UAW strike, where they shut down the big three automakers last year, you saw the writers strike and the actors strike that shut down Hollywood. Every time there's a big high profile strike like that, besides being a demonstration of worker power and what it can do, it's also kind of a billboard to the whole country, to people who don't know about unions, to be like, hey, you can do something. Workers have power. Workers can do things. Workers can win things. And every time that stuff happens, it brings people into the labor movement. So there's always exciting stuff happening in the labor movement all over the country. It's just a matter of multiplying that by 10.
Yeah. And one of my favorite things about, I guess, the past couple of years is, like Hamilton said, a lot of people are realizing that unions can be for them too. It's not just the white guy in a hard hat, which has been kind of this trope that's been offered for so long in so many of the major media quarters. But I mean, we, even outside of Starbucks and Amazon, who have been enormously impactful and they're incredible, like, we've had strippers unionizing around the country, from North Hollywood to Vegas. The Chippendales are unionizing. Like, that is wild and huge. And they're dealing with union busting because they're workers too. Incarcerated workers in Alabama have gotten a lot of attention in the past couple, the past few months. I've covered this. A lot of other people have covered this, just about the issues with exploitation and private companies profiting off of prison labor in this horrific way. And incarcerated workers organize too, whether they're through unions like the IWW or through smaller, more coordinated actions. Like, there are prisoners' unions. There are folks across the South, specifically low-wage fast food workers with the Union of Southern Service Workers, which is a project I think is really fantastic with under the kind of broader Fight for 15 cinematic universe. Like, Waffle House workers have been going on strike. And like, these are folks that have been not only left out of the kind of broader conversation about who the working class is, who a worker is in this country for a very long time, they've kind of been left out of the organized labor movement too. And in some ways, that in some cases, that's because of our rickety labor laws, independent contractor bullshit, misclassification. But there's some workers that have been written off as unorganizable, right? Or they're not worth the investment. Oh, it's too hard to organize retail workers. Tell that to Starbucks. Tell that to the REI workers on strike right now, retail workers in New York City, to all the fast food workers across the country who not only are striking and organizing, but winning, especially in California, where fast food workers, I think they won a $20 minimum wage, which is huge. That took legislative effort and lobbying effort, but it also took a lot of strikes. There are a lot of folks that maybe until fairly recently didn't feel like the labor movement had a place for them, who have either found a place or made a place for themselves. And I think that's one of the most exciting possible developments, because unions are fantastic. We need more people to be part of them. And they're not the right thing for every type of worker. They're not available for every type of worker. So we, meaning the labor movement in general, needs to be supporting independent unions and worker centers and legislative efforts like the strippers in Washington State that won a Bill of Rights, or domestic workers here in Philly a few years ago that won a domestic workers Bill of Rights. Like, there's so many tools at our disposal. We just really need to get better at using them in an effective and militant way, and ensuring that no one is left out or left behind, because that's how the bastards win.
Hell yeah. That's an excellent place, I think, to end. But I do want to ask one last question. This has been a helpful conversation as we think through quickly shifting conditions and all these labor organizing that's happening across the country. It's exciting to see. So I'm sure we're going to want to check back in with you all over the coming months and year. But for our listeners, can you just share with us where they can follow you, what you're working on, if there's any projects you're excited about that are coming that they should be on the lookout for?
You can read my stuff at hamiltonnolan.com. That's my site, How Things Work, where I write most of my stuff. Also, In These Times magazine, great magazine to subscribe to. My book is called The Hammer. You can order it wherever books are sold. And also, shout out to Pittsburgh newspaper, Workers on Strike, Park City, Ski Patrollers on Strike, Virgin Hotel Vegas on strike right now. So yeah, read your local labor news everywhere.
I also get to write for In These Times, which is a killer magazine you should support and donate to. Also write for Teen Vogue. I've got some stuff coming out, The Baffler. Like, I'm freelance, so I'm kind of everywhere. I'm aggressively
and you got online. You got some music stuff too right now, right? You got a little music thing going on?
Oh, I have if you like lefty stuff and also heavy metal, I have a newsletter called Salvo that you can subscribe to. I have my book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, has been out for a little bit. The Young Readers Edition is coming out in May, which I'm really excited about, for ages 10 to 14. Comes out right around time for May Day. I'm working on my third book, which I haven't told people as much about yet. Once I finish my homework, I'll tell you more about that. And I'm aggressively online on Twitter and Blue Sky and Instagram and TikTok. Like, you can't escape me if you come looking for me. So I'm out here. And also, I am so excited with that Philly, my hometown or current hometown, we are about to win the first Whole Foods workers union. Once they win the whole fight, the whole thing. Imagine how Jeff Bezos feels about that. But yeah, and we have the highest union density of coffee shops, like independent coffee shops in the country. So shout out to Philly and go Birds.
Thanks so much for joining us on Counterpunch Radio.
This is great.
We hope to have you both back soon. I feel like this was a very invigorating conversation, and there's not a lot of, dare I say, hope or optimism looking forward, but I feel like this is a conversation that's giving at least me a little bit of that right now. So thanks so much.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give